They floated in front of me, one by one. They would stop in front of my face for a few seconds, then float away, only to be replaced by another face. They weren't scary faces, mostly bearded men who looked like royalty, like what I would guess the Knights of the Round Table resembled. I like to think that I was making some kind of connection with distant ancestors of mine who were perhaps warrior kings. Or I may have just been experiencing indigestion from the hero I had for lunch. Either way, it was unlike anything I've ever experienced. When my hour was up, I didn't want it to end.
My experience in the tank was a bit different. I didn't see any King Lynx from the past, but I did begin to fall asleep several times, which involved my head turning and my open mouth dipping below the surface and filling with water, which is awesome because it was the same water Rhett had just floated in naked. I must admit, though, that when I wasn't choking on salt water, I was having an amazing time. I was totally relaxed. I had no one to answer to. It was just me, alone with myself, nearly drowning every 12 minutes or so. Eventually, I quit falling asleep and had a good 30-minute run of pure peace. This total commitment to nothingness induced a weird sense of euphoria, captured perfectly in the uncontrollable laughter that I experienced upon opening the tank. I remember thinking, I gotta do this again. I need it. However, as awesome as the experience was, I haven't been back to Ed's, and it's not because it was a little awkward sitting in a bathrobe in Ed's garden, eating grapes with him for an hour while waiting for Rhett's turn to end. I haven't returned because it's difficult to make time for myself, even if I have every intention to do so. It was easier to find time for myself when I was a child. I was the weird kid who roamed the neighborhood alone in my army gear. My stepdad, Jimmy, frequently bought me items from the army supply store. Based on the wide array of military accoutrements he gave me, he must have thought that a war could break out in Harnett County at any moment. He outfitted me with an army belt, high-powered camouflaged binoculars, and my prized possession, a giant Bowie knife with a compass built into the handle. I would gear up and head out into a horse pasture behind my house, going on patrol. A compass isn't particularly helpful for navigating a small, fenced horse pasture, and I was never sure what exactly I should be stabbing with my knife blade. But I felt ready for anything. I would sit in a corner of the pasture and survey the grass with my discreet binoculars. Occasionally, there was a teenage girl who would ride a horse there. I think her name was Amy, and I'm pretty sure she did pageants. She would see me crouching in the corner, ride up to me and ask, "What are you doing out here?" Never removing my eyes from the binoculars, I would just sit there and say nothing. I thought that if I remained perfectly quiet and still, she wouldn't be able to see me. After a while, she would just trot away on her horse. I remember thinking that she had nice hair and wishing that she would ask me to ride the horse with her. She never did. I never accomplished anything particularly notable while on patrol, but it was my time. I was connecting with myself.
As far back as I can remember, I've always been drawn to the idea of solitude. And I've always loved stories about people who were alone for long periods of time. One of my favorite books as a kid was My Side of the Mountain, a novel about a 12-year-old boy who runs away from his family and lives inside a hollowed-out tree. I consider it to be one of the best books ever written for kids, even if it inspired a whole generation of us to run away from home. Despite my romantic idea of solitude, up until recently, I had never spent a night alone in the wilderness. That changed in early 2016 when my wife and kids were back in North Carolina visiting family. I knew it was time for me to finally do it. I would spend the night alone in the desert. I would not simply go to a campground where I would be surrounded by other people in tents. No, I would head deep into the desert and set up my camp in a place where I wouldn't come across another person. I found the perfect spot outside of Joshua Tree National Park. As I set up my camp in the daytime, I was loving every minute. Sure, I still had cell service, and my car was less than 20 feet away, but I was alone. I was going to just sit with myself and think, and it was going to be glorious. But then it began to get dark, and I got scared. I'm ashamed to say, in order to fight that isolated, vulnerable feeling, I went on Instagram. As the sky grew darker, I got even more afraid. Looking into my fire, I began to worry about all the things that might sneak up behind me. Are coyotes afraid of fire, or are they attracted to it? Are there bears in the desert? What about crazy people with machetes? Then my mind truly went wild. I began to ponder that if the many-worlds interpretation of quantum physics is true, and there are an infinite number of alternate realities branching off from my reality, then there is actually a world in which I am currently being attacked by a pack of coyotes, and another world in which I'm being ripped apart by a desert bear, and yet another world where I'm being killed by a machete-wielding desert maniac. There's even a world where all three of these things are happening at the same time to one Rhett. As I began to get scared for the version of me that was being triple-teamed by this awful coyote-bear-man gang, I reached my breaking point, retreated into my tent, and watched Superbad on my laptop to make the fear subside. I woke up the next morning feeling better. I then posted a shirtless selfie that I somewhat regret.
If these stories prove anything, it's that things can get weird when we're alone. It leads to strange, binoculared interactions with women on horseback and face-to-face meetings with bearded ancestors. Despite the nature of our experiences, we want to be alone more so we can get better at solitude. Alone time can help a friendship because being apart from someone often makes you better at being with them. If this brings back memories from the time your high school sweetheart went to college across the country telling you, "We need some time apart so we can be better together," only to return next summer with her hand in the back pants pocket of someone who looked exactly like you, we're sorry. That is not our intention. Plus, being alone creates the mental space for us to recharge individually, sparking our creativity and helping us recapture a fresh perspective on our work.
Despite all the benefits, making a commitment to find time for yourself isn't easy. If you're like us, it only happens if you plan it. As we write this chapter, we are scheduling a return to the float tank. Link will be fully caffeinated to avoid sleep drowning, and Rhett will be prepared with questions for his ancient royal uncles to find out exactly who they are. And we promise that the next time either of us willingly spends a night alone in the wilderness, there will be no pseudo-sexy self-portraits. Well, there will probably be a lot, but we will share them only with our wives.
Planning your perfect day of self-seclusion.
Picture this. After months of work or school commitments, family responsibilities, social functions, and so on, your schedule is finally clear. Wake up in the morning with no appointments on the calendar and no people around. How do you feel? Free? Excited? Anxious? Confused? For some people, just the thought of having a day to themselves can be overwhelming, which is why we have taken the liberty of planning your day of self-seclusion for you. What's more, we've given you three environments for living out your perfect day alone. Glamping, a rainy day inside, and miles from civilization on the African savannah.
6 a.m. Glamping. Zip up your polar performance fleece, grab an espresso to go from your battery-powered Keurig, grab your self-propelled micro-lattice walking sticks, and set out for an early morning walk as the forest begins to wake up. If you're lucky, you might catch a glimpse of a rare bird, or perhaps a mother doe taking her fawns to the side of the river for a drink.
6 a.m., a rainy day inside. Roll over, scratch your butt, and resume snoring.
6 a.m., miles from civilization on the African savannah. Having not had any protein since your Jeep broke down 2 days ago, you wake up famished. You should head to the river where, if you're lucky, you'll be able to kill a rare bird or a weak deer who has walked to the river for a drink. If not, you must choose between another day without food or some of the mysterious yellow berries that have given you explosive diarrhea for the past 30 hours.
8 a.m., glamping. Look for a couple of sturdy trees between which the staff can hang the hammock you bought from Brookstone. You're probably pretty tired from your walk and you deserve a nap. Better yet, you deserve the prepackaged paleo snacks from the Roughing It section at Whole Foods.
8 a.m., a rainy day inside. Begin the 90-minute process of considering whether or not to get out of bed.
8 a.m., miles from civilization on the African savannah. If you don't build a protective shelter, you will likely not survive another night. Not with that family of African lions prowling about. Start building now. You have roughly 3 hours to construct your crude attempt at shelter before the sun reaches its peak, at which point the oppressive heat could kill you, or at least cause you to black out and become susceptible to a rock python attack.
Noon. Glamping. Wait a minute. Did you just fall asleep, silly? You promised yourself that you wouldn't take a nap until after your moderate hike to the waterfall. No matter. When it's just you versus the elements in nature, rules go out the window. Now, hurry up or the golf cart will leave without you and you'll have to walk the quarter mile to the trailhead.
Noon. A rainy day inside. Stare at the expiration date on the cottage cheese until the numbers change.
Noon. Miles from civilization on the African savanna. Consider fashioning a crude spear. There's no way you'll be able to kill anything with it, and potential predators will view your spear as less of a threat than a Nerf gun, but at least it will occupy your mind for a few minutes and distract you from the pain of your stomach eating itself.
3 p.m. Glamping. Stop FaceTiming. Seriously. And turn off Netflix. Just because your $10,000 force-filled back pop tent has multimedia features, that doesn't mean you need to use them all concurrently. Go back outside for at least another 30 minutes before you walk up to the lodge for happy hour.
3 p.m., a rainy day inside. Roll over, scratch your butt, and resume snoring.
3 p.m., miles from civilization on the African savanna. Stare ominously at the impending storm clouds on the horizon. Your shelter might be able to shield you from the lions and leopards, but your roof is not waterproof and will offer no protection from the rain. Take off your clothes. They will become a danger to you when they are soaking in cold. On the bright side, the weather will deter the insects from attempting to burrow into your orifices like they did last night.
6 p.m. Glamping. Well, now you've done it. Your inability to say no to the seafood tower guarantees that you will underappreciate your soup course, let alone the prime rib. Slow down. It's raining outside, which means you might as well stay at the restaurant for a few more hours.
6 p.m., rainy day inside. You realize you haven't showered in a week, but you also haven't watched all 8 Fast and the Furious movies back to back.
6 p.m., miles from civilization on the African savanna. The rain pounds your starving body as the temperature drops 20 degrees. If nature doesn't give you a break, hypothermia is a real possibility. You consider peeing on yourself for warmth, but decide against it. Not because it will only provide temporary relief, but because there is no liquid in your bladder since you didn't catch any of the rain runoff.
9 p.m., glamping. Once your complimentary camping assistant, Gerald, lays out your self-inflating mattress in the tent, lie down and let the sounds of nature, along with the wine and martinis from dinner, help you drift off to sleep. Remember to tip Gerald before he returns to the lodge.
9 p.m., a rainy day inside. Vin Diesel is an even better actor than you remember. Bring on Tokyo Drift.
9 p.m., miles from civilization on the African savanna. You fell asleep for a minute, but the sounds of 2 lions slaughtering a wild boar startle you awake. The boar's screams are like nothing you've ever heard, and you can't help but think that the only thing preventing you from screaming like that is a weak perimeter of thorny bushes and a poorly made spear.
Midnight. Glamping. Let's not kid ourselves. A pack of lions couldn't even wake you up before 8 a.m. Hashtag foie gras makes me sleepy.
Midnight, a rainy day inside. More disruptive, getting up to use the bathroom or not getting up to use the bathroom.
Midnight, miles from civilization on the African savanna. You are startled awake by a pack of lions. The sky is an unnatural shade of purple. The hunger pains have subsided. Are you dead? You must be dead. Otherwise, you would feel more afraid. Maybe you're losing your mind. Not a bad thought, actually, considering the alternatives for you once the big cats discover the weak joints in your shelter. Then again, what if this was all a dream?
Chapter 19.
Speak at your own funeral.
Leslie Peebles was our first girlfriend. We say our, not because we dated her at the same time, but because she was the first girlfriend each of us had, independently. Buies Creek was a small town. One of the alluring things about Leslie was the fact that her parents ran a funeral home. The whole place was cloaked in mystery. We both wondered if, by entering into a relationship with Leslie, we'd gain some secret knowledge about what happened there, or at least see a dead body.
Leslie never had much patience for our inquiries about the finer aspects of body preparation. If we ask her a question about sewing mouths or other orifices shut, she changed the subject. Ultimately, she dumped both of us after about a month. Rhett in 6th grade, me in 7th grade. Apparently, 4 weeks of constant badgering about the embalming process was all she could handle.
Thankfully, Leslie's mom liked both of us. And years later, in 2007, she even allowed us to make a video at the funeral home. And more specifically, get inside a coffin. We know, it's weird. The video didn't amount to much, but we learned something important that day. All the nice white quilting that lines a coffin may make it look like dead people are resting on a comfortable cloud, but it's not comfortable at all. It's cold, it's hard, and it features two unforgiving crossbeams. Not that deceased people give a rip. The frilly decoration isn't for them. It's for the people left behind who hoped that their casket fashion choices would have pleased the dearly departed.
In fact, everything about funerals is up to the folks left behind to worry about. Not just the coffins, but also the music, the guest list, the fried chicken, the jello mold, and unfortunately, the stories. This is a problem.
When a person passes away, they immediately relinquish control of how they'll be remembered. This is like a filmmaker working on a movie for years, getting every detail of an epic adventure right, and then suddenly handing the final scene over to someone else who decides to reveal that the whole thing was just a dream. This cheap trick will forever be acceptable only in The Wizard of Oz. Your funeral is your last chance to control the narrative of your life, and we personally think that most people get it dead wrong.
Let's start with the obituary. You can't leave this up to grieving relatives. They're in no position to pin your masterpiece, especially if your death was unexpected. You need to write your own obit, or at least seek out someone who once blogged for a few months. Keep it short, sweet, and of course, funny. The people you leave behind are going to appreciate a laugh during this time, and they'll probably be even more grateful that you took care of this beforehand. As far as what to write, maybe our draft obituaries can serve as an inspiration. Naturally, there's a fair amount of guesswork involved, but the pertinent details can be updated later depending on the circumstances surrounding our deaths.
Rhett James McLaughlin, 99, died Sunday when his self-driving flying automobile became sentient and self-destructed by flying into some seaside cliffs, creating a massive fireball that could be seen for miles. He leaves behind his beautiful and loving wife, Jessie, who will no doubt soon be on the prowl for a significantly younger and shorter man, and two sons, Locke and Shepard, who continue to valiantly serve in our ongoing struggle against the robot overlords. Mr. McLaughlin was one of the hosts of Good Mythical Morning, which featured him and his lifelong best friend, Link Neal, talking to each other about various topics of interest, and occasionally eating things like bull testicles and pig anus. Apparently, this kind of thing was considered humorous in the earlier parts of the 21st century. In more recent years, Rhett and Link had completely lost their relevance, never fully adjusting to the new comedy. Rhett had turned to whittling in order to ease the pain of a floundering career, and he even went on to win several awards, including Best Duck at the 2051 Greater Los Angeles Whittling Expo. Of course, he was stripped of all his accolades when it was discovered that he was just 3D printing all of his entries, but he never lost a sense of accomplishment.
Charles Lincoln, Link, Neal III, died peacefully in his sleep on Sunday at the age of 98. He was taking a power nap beneath some seaside cliffs and was struck by flying automobile debris. He is survived by his beauteous and splendid wife, Christy, and their three children, Lily, Lincoln, and Lando, their nine grandchildren, Charles Lincoln Neal V, Lofton, Lork, Londa, Larry, Liquids, Lava Rock, Logan, and Lychee, and their great-grandchildren, Lufa, Lufus, Lufrus, Lasper, Linda, Layson, Lykel, Larbra, Lorax, LeSteven, LeSheila, LaDarius, Lalcano, LL Cool L, Lantronce, Looky Looky, Liquinox, Loriangle, Levitate, LeBron James, Leather, Loaves, Lobe, Limb, Lob, Lop, Lab, Lee, Lou, Low, and Tom. Mr. Neal gained semi-notable fame as co-host of the internet program Good Mythical Morning, along with local duck whittler Rhett McLaughlin in the 2010s. Then, in 2021, he embarked on his masterwork, manufacturing intelligent refrigerators that suggested exactly the right food to eat when you open them. This inadvertently led to his pioneering advancements in the worlds of both car and robot consciousness. He is known globally as the father of the robot overlords.
An obituary is only the beginning. It's the funeral service that holds much more weight. Your family and friends will gather together and summarize your entire life in less than an hour. Contrary to popular belief, the details will not take care of themselves. No, sir. So many things can go wrong. The person best equipped to handle the particulars of your funeral is the person being funeralized. That's you. Our condolences.
Let's start with the number one funeral mistake. The open casket. This is never a good idea, even if you die in your sleep, fully toned and tanned, with no crazy battle wounds. You don't want the last image that people remember of you to be you sleeping in caked on makeup with your butt sewed shut. Sure, they can't see the sewn-up butthole, but everyone will know it's there, and you don't want them thinking about it. Go with a closed casket, or better yet, cremation. A fail-safe strategy is getting a nice urn for your ashes and placing it next to a framed picture of you from your physical peak, or right after you return from Hawaii.
Making sure nobody sees your dead self is only half the battle. Since the turn of the century, it has become customary for a slideshow accompanied by music to play on repeat prior to the funeral service. If you let your surviving family and friends choose these photos, they will select pictures that make them and their children look good, not you. You risk having a slideshow full of lazy-eyed, half-mouth-open pictures of yourself.
We suggest hiring a photographer every couple of years to take pictures of you doing interesting things, like sharing a milkshake with a chimpanzee, delivering a baby in a cave, or being knighted by the Queen of England. If you can't afford a photographer, tasteful photo editing is passable. Pepper these intriguing pictures into the slideshow to leave people with the sense that there was even more to you than there actually was. If this seems disingenuous, remember that it will be super inspiring, and that makes it worth it.
The importance of music cannot be overemphasized. If you leave this to chance, it's not unlikely that your slideshow will feature Pachelbel's Canon in D on repeat. This is unacceptable. There are two recommended strategies for building your funeral playlist. The simple method is choosing music that you would have had on a personal playlist, the kind of music that represents you and your musical taste. A more involved plan, assuming you've included the right pictures in your slideshow as described above, is to sync your music to the pictures to elicit maximum emotional engagement from the audience. For example, Randy Newman's You've Got a Friend in Me would be the perfect companion to your Milkshake with Chimpanzee photo series, while the original MacGyver theme would play well with the cave baby delivery.
You could get the obituary, slideshow, and music perfect. But if the words spoken about you at the service don't deliver, your funeral will be a fail. Naturally, friends and family will want to say something, and they should go for it. Hopefully, you'll have lived the kind of life that generates good stories, as opposed to a series of thinly veiled grievances. However, a mythical funeral should definitely include a word from the person who died and brought everyone together. Again, that's you. Sorry.
Hopefully, by the time you die, hologram technology will have progressed to a place where it will seem like you are actually standing up front at your funeral. But assuming that's still years away, the best you can do at the moment is make a video. Do it however you want. If you'd prefer to do a jump cut-filled vlog while sitting on the edge of your bed, that could work. Or you may want to memorize a soliloquy and deliver it in a rich Shakespearean tone. How you deliver your words is not nearly as important as what you say. We offer up our own self-eulogies in hopes that they might provide a bit of inspiration.
Good mythical funeral! Thanks so much for being here. That makes one of us. Ha 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 ha! I recommend starting with a joke. Anyways, I want to go ahead and apologize for the non-skippable ad on the front of this video. Papa gotta pay for that custom-made, me-shaped urn. Listen, I don't want this to be a solemn affair. I've rented out this entire Cheesecake Factory, and Lionel Richie's All Night Long is playing in the background for one reason, to have fun. So let's all stand and follow along with the words on the screen. Deceased. Tombalite sete moya. Congregation. Yeah, jumbo jumbo. Deceased. Way to party, oh we going. Congregation. Oh jambalaya. Thank you. You may be seated. Truly, I have lived a jumbo jumbo life. My job was to make internet videos with my best friend. Of course, there were some things that I never got to do, like water ski off a ramp through a ring of flaming hot Cheetos that were actually on fire. Unless, of course, I did finally get to do that, and that's what killed me. Man, that would be quite ironic, slash tragic, slash awesome. I got old, but I never grew up, like a lost boy or an old bush. I loved my wife and my kids with everything I had, and I loved many of you with what was left over. I probably should have said that differently, but of course, I didn't script this out ahead of time. Tonight, let's celebrate the love and life we shared. Thank you for the difference you made in my life. Enjoy the cheesecake.
Here's mine. Hello, everyone. I wish I could be here under different circumstances, specifically circumstances in which I am not dead. But apparently I am gone. And I'm guessing that it was sudden and unexpected. Actually, I know it was, because this is the sudden and unexpected death version of my funeral speech. I also have a Saw It Coming for Months version available if you're interested. It's pretty much the same as this one, but it starts a little differently. While it's never easy to say goodbye, I'd like you to take comfort that I died with few regrets. Well, I regret clicking on that YouTube video, 20-year-old blackhead removed. But other than that, things were pretty good. I'm incredibly thankful to my wife, Jessie, but I won't be going into too much detail about that because I made a special private video just for her. If I showed you all some of the things that I did for that video, it would probably make you feel very uncomfortable, and everyone under 17 would have to leave the room. I'm also extremely proud of my sons, Locke and Shepherd. They only embarrassed our family a handful of times. I'd also like to take a moment to thank my best friend, Link. Of course, there's a chance we died together doing something stupid to entertain people. If so, please don't forget to play the joint funeral video that we made in preparation for just that situation. It's very entertaining and involves a coordinated dance number that we worked on for weeks. You'll love it. Well, anyway, don't die on the way home. That would be a real bummer, dying on the way home from a funeral. Now I'm rambling. Farewell.
As you can see, we put quite a bit of thought into our sign-offs. However, a mythical funeral doesn't necessarily have to include shout-outs to Cheetos and blackheads. Ultimately, what makes a funeral mythical is you taking the time to think about the way you want to be remembered instead of leaving it up to your loved ones alone. We know nobody likes to talk about dying, and it seems unnecessarily morbid to consider your death if you don't know it's right around the corner. Just remember that if you don't discuss it now, you may end up lying there in that velour suit you absolutely hate while everybody sits and looks at you, thinking of nothing other than your sewn-up tuchus. Don't let that happen.
Rhett and Link Funeral Hymn.
Given the amount of time we spend together, it is not unlikely that we will die at the same time. Of course, we are requesting a joint funeral if this happens. We are requesting separate urns, however. We do not want our ashes mixed.
We have written a song to lighten the mood for the occasion. It isn't like our typical songs, no pop chord progressions and no funky beat. This is a funeral dirge.
You felt a gentle warm breeze because we breathed on you. You found your fly was down. That was us too. You may think we're dead and gone. You'd be right almost. Yes, we are totally dead, but we're still here as ghosts. But you really should think about the things you do alone, especially that one thing. It's still awkward even though we're ghosts. You may think we're dead and gone. You'd be right almost. Yes, we are totally dead, but we're still here as ghosts.
Chapter 20.
Stop and Celebrate.
Back when we were kids, there was a cow pasture that we often visited. We weren't aspiring farmers, we just enjoyed chasing the cows, and getting the whole herd to run across the field made us feel like we were accomplishing something big. After running around, We would sit down on some large rocks in the middle of the pasture and have overly earnest conversations about our future. We always had a sense that our friendship would last and that we were destined to do something together.
One day, in the midst of an especially serious talk, we found the sharpest rock we could, cut our hands with it, and swore a blood oath to each other, promising to, quote, work together creating something, end quote. If you had told us then that more than 25 years later, we would be living in Los Angeles, making a show where we did things like deep-fry sunglasses in front of millions of people, we would probably respond, really? That's the something we're going to do together? But here we are.
Although we have a tendency to do things as ceremonious as blood oaths as kids, now that we're actually in the middle of living out our childhood dream, it seems we rarely stop to appreciate the moment. Instead, we all too often just let the years fly by, moving hastily from one thing to the next.
The day that we wrapped season one of our comedy series Buddy System provides a perfect example of our tendency to move on without pausing to take it all in. Buddy System represented a huge step for us. We had always dreamed of telling a story full of weird ideas, like creating a second version of ourselves in a hallucination, then, after singing a barbershop quartet with our alter egos, murdering and burying them. We had the privilege of conceptualizing this crazy story and then spending a month and a half bringing those ideas to life on screen. After acting, dancing, and singing for 12 hours a day, it came down to our last scene, the flashback of our high school prom.
It was over 100 degrees outside that Friday, and the crew had to turn off the AC in the gymnasium every time we rolled camera in order to capture clean audio. We were performing the BFF song, our 90s boy band throwback dance number, and sweating profusely in our white tuxedos. When we finally ran out of time, our director, John, yelled, "Cut!" And our assistant director, Matt, shouted the traditional, "That's a wrap!" Everyone cheered to celebrate a successful shoot and began to hug one another. It would have been the perfect time for us to stop and make a heartfelt speech about how great of an experience it was for us, and to take a second to express our appreciation for our amazing crew. But our line producer, Marcy, made the mistake of telling us that we had finished 20 minutes early. That meant we still technically had more time to shoot. We told everyone to stop hugging and proceeded to sing and dance until the last possible minute, hoping we could get just a little more footage.
That night we rode together back home, barely talking because we were so exhausted. When we parted ways, I said, "We did it." And then we shook hands. That was all. No ceremony, no champagne, just a handshake. We had finally completed something that we'd been working toward our entire career, and all we did was shake hands like two old farmers agreeing on where to build a fence. The very next Monday, we were already discussing GMM Season 10 and beginning to work on this very book.
It's easy to get caught up in your responsibilities, buying into the belief that something might slip through the cracks and receive inadequate attention if you don't move right to it as soon as you have the chance. And it doesn't matter what your job is. We're not international ambassadors negotiating peace between warring nations. We're two dudes who drink each other's urine through a filter. This isn't life or death stuff. But we take it seriously. And we get so engrossed in our work that we often forget to stop and appreciate the present.
We also tend to be highly critical of ourselves. When we finish a project or an episode of GMM, we're usually thinking, we'll get it right next time. This leads us to living in a constant state of anticipation, always looking to the next opportunity to do something well. This cycle of doubt and anticipation only makes it harder to stop and celebrate.
It goes without saying that this is not a particularly mythical way to approach life. One of the key tenets of mythicality is bringing more good into the world, and that involves a willingness to direct some goodwill towards yourself. We're not talking about gloating about your accomplishments, but rather recognizing that it's perfectly okay, and even recommended, to take time to reflect on a personal achievement. Ironically, pausing to reflect on something you're proud of is a great way to develop a sense of humility. For instance, when we stop and think about another season of Good Mythical Morning Rapping, we're struck by all the amazing people who enable us to pull off this work. That fills us with deep gratitude.
Of course, just like a lot of mythical things, this is all much more easily said than done. But it's not impossible. We're committed to adding some mythicality to our lives by making sure to actually schedule a time to sit down and appreciate the present as it's happening. When we finish this book, we're not just going to move right along to the next thing. At the moment we hold the final product in our hands, we're going to do something ceremonial, something substantial to celebrate and reflect. It won't involve any animal sacrifice, chants, or tattoos, but we'll at least take the book out to a restaurant, set it in between us on the table, and try to enjoy a hearty steak dinner without spilling any hollandaise sauce on it. And we'll let it all sink in. The feeling of finishing the book, not the hollandaise.
We've missed quite a few opportunities to celebrate the present and the past, so we've created the following timeline of milestones along with how we would mark those moments if we could go back in time. We've avoided significant milestones like getting married or having our kids, because we think we actually did a pretty good job of stopping to appreciate those moments.
Celebration rectification timeline.
1987. What happened? I beat Super Mario Brothers using only one life while Link watched in amazement. We should have dressed up in overalls and shared some mushroom linguine.
1992. What happened? We successfully dammed the small creek running behind Ben Greenwood's house with rocks and tree limbs. The dam held for a full 3 hours. We should have had a dam ceremony.
1995. What happened? We, along with 9 of our friends, who were all piled in the back of Link's truck, survived a fairly serious wreck while egging houses on Halloween night in the upscale community of Neal's Creek Farms in Andrew, North Carolina. We should have invited all of our friends who were with us that night to a big omelet breakfast where we reflected on the fragility of life and then went door to door to apologize to the recipients of our eggs.
1996. What happened? Our high school band, the Wax Paper Dogs, came in second place in Buies Creek Battle of the Bands, finishing just behind the aptly named, short-lived local phenomenon, 15 Minutes of Fame. We should have participated in a 15-minute-long back massage circle.
1998. What happened? We invited approximately 50 girls we didn't know to come to our apartment to watch the original Planet of the Apes by splitting the signal from a VCR to 3 TVs. We should have invited them back over for 4 consecutive weekends to watch Beneath the Planet of the Apes, Escape from the Planet of the Apes, Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, and Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
2001. What happened? We wrote one of our first comedy songs, The Unibrow Song, and performed for a crowd of college students who actually laughed at it. We should have temporarily grown our unibrows back in.
2003. What happened? We each separately spearheaded projects at our respective engineering companies, all while wearing khakis. We should have had a cake made with the words, "We are officially adults now. People may die if we've made mistakes in our calculations," written on it.
2006. What happened? Our first YouTube video got 1,000 views. We should have grabbed a drink with the person who ripped the video from our website and posted it on YouTube, thanking them for helping us to understand why it didn't make sense to have our videos only on our own server, and then kindly asking them to take it down.
2009. What happened? We were interviewed on CNN after the success of our commercial for Red House Furniture, which featured the tagline, "Where black people and white people buy furniture." We should have had a party at the Red House with lots of black and white people.
2011. What happened? LMFAO asked us if they could use our dope zebra in their Sorry for Party Rockin' music video. We said yes, if we could be in the video too, and it worked. We should have taken a celebratory trip to the zoo while wearing the zebra costume.
2016. What happened? We made it to our 1,000th episode of Good Mythical Morning. We should have. Actually, we did pretty good with this one. A fan montage video even made us cry on the show.
We hope that our reminiscing will inspire you, and us, to begin taking the time to stop and celebrate life's little victories. Remember, you don't have to wait for major stuff like birthdays, marriages, and promotions to celebrate. Most of us already do a pretty good job of recognizing those achievements. Instead, make it a habit to congratulate yourself for the stuff that often goes unnoticed, like finally making a properly proportioned milkshake, living through a second heart attack, or enjoying a successful one wiper.
And just like we have promised to celebrate the day we finally finish writing this book, we want to give you an opportunity to celebrate when you finish listening to the book, which is basically right now. To mark this occasion, we encourage you to snap a selfie of you listening to the book with the biggest, toothiest smile you can possibly make and include the caption, "I just listened to Rhett and Link's hashtag Book of Mythicality." You may find it odd that the authors of a book would ask you to take a picture of yourself after completing the book, but we're guessing that, if you made it this far, you probably understand that it's pretty mythical too.
A mythical farewell. If any of our stories about poorly placed time capsules, lost dogs, cereal baths, tobacco sickness, bad haircuts, homemade wine, or isolation tank hallucinations have made you laugh or think, we have succeeded in our mission of bringing some mythicality into the world through this book. If you have not laughed or thought, but instead passively digested this book like a zombie who, despite its lack of blood flow and inability to walk without a limp, has somehow retained reading comprehension skills, then congratulations. That's really impressive. We're surprised you held on this long.
What we were really striving for, though, is that something in this book has compelled you to take the risk of bringing more curiosity, creativity, or tomfoolery into your life and friendships. If we've helped you identify an area in your life that's in need of mythicality and inspired you to take the mythical action you know is necessary, then that means you're well on your way to feeding your inner mythical beast. That's what we're all about.
But being mythical isn't always easy. Even though laughing, learning, and creating are at the heart of our jobs, we've seen how the busyness and challenges of life can make those things difficult to do. It's easy to get in a rut where laughter is tough to come by and creating seems like a chore. It's also tough to not let pettiness or jealousy chip away at a potentially mythical friendship. Fortunately, as you take more mythical actions, mythicality becomes a more natural part of your life and your relationships.
We have no specific plans to raise an official army of mythical beasts, although it would be very cool to have matching uniforms and be strategically dropped in certain areas around the world to unleash weapons of mass mythicality. We would just need to make absolutely sure that our uniforms did not make us look like a herd of furries. However, there is little doubt that the world is in need of more people who don't take themselves too seriously and are willing to learn, try, and create new things.
And so, maybe instead of donning a mythical uniform, you can begin to share the ways you've added mythicality to your life, encouraging others in their own mythical quests, and also so we can hear from you. We're all on this mythical highway together. We wish you well in your mythical adventures.
Now go and be your mythical best.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Rhett and Link's Book of Mythicality, a field guide to curiosity, creativity, and tomfoolery, written and performed by Rhett McLaughlin and Link Neal. Executive producers, Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik. Producer, Kat Lambrix. Directed by Chris Sacco. Edited and mastered by Brian Corcoran. Mixed by Brett Lebansky. Copyright 2017 by Rhett James McLaughlin and Charles Lincoln Link Neal III. Sound recording copyright 2017 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.